Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, sitting in the Duck South Studios on this. I guess this is probably going to go out on the weekend, Ramsey. Since we missed on Thursday, I'm joined by Double R2 himself. Ramsey,
Rocky, how you doing?
I know you jumped out of bed to go turkey hunting this morning.
No, sir. Man, I wouldn't. There's a lot I'd get out of bed for. Turkey hunting ain't one of them. This year in Rocky. You know, hey, been down to Argentina many, many times, down in South America, and one of the big delicacies down there is blood sausage. Blood sausage. And I've tried it 20 times. It's an acquired taste. Everybody I know down there loves it. All my Argentinian and Peruvian friends love it. And I've tried it, and I've tried it, and I've tried it, and I just don't like it. I realize, you know, I can eat this all every time I'm here, and I'm never going to acquire the taste. And that's the way I am with turkey hunting. I've killed 10 turkeys in my whole life, and I've killed some good ones, but I just don't. Now, Forrest is fired up about that stuff, man. He got up this morning, and I texted him at, 4:30 this morning and said, you know, turkey woods, and he was heading that way. Drove clear out somewhere, and I think he's got a turkey found for in the morning, but I could care less, Rocky. Isn't that terrible?
You know, you're so task-oriented, though. And that's kind of what turkey hunting is. You go duck hunting, duck's going to do what duck's going to do. A turkey is a chess match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just don't get it. I went turkey hunting with Forrest last year, hunting with Dakota Stiles out in Oklahoma. And we had turkeys. There were turkeys, man. We set up on them, and the gobblers were, you could see them across this big patch, and they were in the back. You knew it was just matter of time, because where we were set up, they had come right down to this little funnel, and the parade of turkeys was going by, and I was playing on my phone, and the old turkey was sitting out there too far to shoot, and just messing around, and, you know, my heart didn't skip a beat. I got a text, and I was dying just to see who it was from, what was going on. I could care less. And those turkeys walked on through, and they walked through the funnel, and we kind of eased up over that hill, and there he was, and I pulled the trigger. I don't know, Rocky, I've tried it, and I've had some good turkey hunting experiences in the past, but I'm just not a turkey hunter. I've tried it, and I've got buddies that turkey hunt, and I hear their stories, and it's interesting. Forrest loves it, but I just can't do it. I just don't care. I like even being in the woods this time of year. You know, it's beautiful, but I'm just not a turkey hunter. And Rocky, you know, I already spend 150, 200 days a year traveling. If I did get the turkey hunting bug, I might as well just move out. I'm not going to ever be home. That's where I've been. That's where I've been the last. I got home Tuesday from Azerbaijan and had a whole lot of fire to put out and get settled in. And I'm still not settled in. You asked me a couple of podcasts ago how long it takes to get acclimated to the time change. And I'm still not acclimated to the time change. I've been going to bed at 8:30 and waking up at 2:30 or 3 here in Mississippi. And last thing I'm going to do is get up and go turkey hunting. I'm going to tell you.
So, have you killed all of them towards a slam?
No, I have not. I've, you know, at Get Ducks, we've sold turkey hunts in the past, and just especially Mexico, the Ghouls and the Isolated. We've done some work in Rios. We sold some Osceola hunt there briefly while that outfitter was still going pretty good. I lack only the Miriams for the World Slam. I've killed 10 turkeys, including the Rio I shot last year in Oklahoma. I've killed 10 turkeys. And I've been fortunate by turkey hunter standards. The first gobbler I ever shot, I should say I've shot 10 gobblers. The first gobbler, the first bearded bird I ever shot was had a 13-inch beard. You know, practically 13 nice. Inches. It just stretched right on out to about 13 inches. It was in Alabama, and a old friend of mine, he's been IRS agent, now retired since deceased. We went over to Alabama, and he called it in. We had chased for a couple of days, and that's back in the days I was still kind of experimenting with wanting to be a turkey hunter and trying to be a turkey hunter, I should say, and called it right in. And it was a little exciting, and shot him, and he's a good bird. And some friends of mine that knew taxidermy kind of, you know, I cut the fan off, pulled the beard out, and cut the feet off and mounted it myself, and turned out pretty darn good, you know. And then as years went on and the house situation changed, I finally just cut the spurs off and did something different with the beard, and just got it kind of hung up with the rest of them. And another bird I shot, another memorable bird, a fraternity brother of mine at Mississippi State. We spent the whole spring semester preceding our graduating college fishing. I mean, I think 5 or 6 afternoons a year, a week we were out there fishing somewhere around Starkville. Just the way our schedules were, I did real good that year. I was on the president's list. We still had a lot of time to bass fish. And we got to talking right there around this time of year. Around spring break, he was going home to Lincoln County, and he said, I just can't believe you're not a turkey hunter. We had the same conversation. I said, I'm just nice. Well, come on down there. We'll go turkey hunting. And it was just too easy. We went out. We walked around the woods. We saw turkeys and set up the next morning. Wah, wah, wah. I had three gobblers in my lap come running uphill. And as they were running to me, I didn't know what to do, so I didn't raise my gun. And next thing I know, they're just sitting right there in my lap, three of them, looking around. One of them kind of cocked his head and was studying me up and down with one eyeball. And Steve goes, just kind of spooked them. And they huddled up. When they moved again, I raised my gun. And he later said, you know, I was scared to death he's going to pull a trigger and kill all three of them. I waited till they kind of just relaxed and spread back out a little bit and shot one. And that was a pretty exciting hunt, I will say. I thought I might get the turkey bug then, but I didn't. And just feeling around with it on and off, you know. One time I was with a client in South Carolina. It was one of the most beautiful turkey properties I've ever set foot on. It was right on I wish I could remember the name of that river, famous river out there south of Charleston. And the water was just as black as coffee with all the tannic acid, but the soil was extremely sandy. And pine trees, very, very, very burned and well managed and planted in chufa. And I mean, just really, really textbook perfect turkey habitat. And I think it was Forrest and I both shot one that morning, a gobbler, and I got back and he said, well, go back out and get another one. So I turned around and went back out with a guy, and we were walking down the road, and by the time he jumped back, you know, we're just winding down, walking down a winding road, he jumped back and said, here comes a gobbler, get in the bushes. And all he seen was that beard. And we jumped off the road and found a pine tree. Well, it was just the where I was sitting was lower than the road. And I was like eyeball level, a turkey's head, but there was a lot of honeysuckle growing up on the edge of the road. So I was kind of looking through the screen honeysuckle. And you know, the turkey just was, oh, it couldn't have been, came by, it couldn't have been more than 10 yards away. and just right there, just stop. And I just kind of, and it stopped. And all I could just see was just a vague outline of turkey and that beard. Boom, I pulled the trigger. When I got up, it was a hen.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh, this guy is going to kill me. He's got this beautiful property. And I just shot a hen, and I flipped it over, and it had a beard. Oh, my. And the whole way back, I just walked, just the whole mile was like a walk of shame. And I shot a hen, you know. And when I got there, he pat me on the back and said, oh, no, any bearded bird is legal. He said, so that's a legal bird, man. Congratulations. You don't see many bearded hens. That's kind of cool, you know.
But you've killed an isolated turkey, though. I mean, that had to be a heart-pumping deal.
It would. Now I'm going to say this. I've killed two isolateds. And that was maybe one of my all-time top 10 favorite hunting trips ever. That for that isolated turkey, and it wasn't just the bird. You know, Rocky, everybody kind of gathers and knows. We chase a lot of species. I chase a lot of species around the world of waterfowl and game birds. But for me, it's really not duck. It's not the species. It's where the chase for that unique species takes me. That's what, like, Azerbaijan's a fine example. It's just a perfect example. It's not necessarily the red-crested poacher or that species. It's just that immersive experience of being in it. And for me, isolated turkeys was just an epic adventure. And it was so good that a few years later, I went back with some clients and had the chance to shoot several more and did not, because I had no intention of shooting another turkey. I actually wanted to shoot a brocket deer, and I just don't have luck for brocket deer at all. I don't have any luck whatsoever, because both times I've been, I haven't laid eyeballs on one, and they appear to stampede over everybody else in camp. But a little diminutive, probably a 30-40 pound deer with little spiked antlers. Don't ask me why I'd like to shoot one. I would. But I've been down there. The first time I went, you hunt them out. You hunt those turkeys out on the eastern side of Mexico in Campeche, out on the peninsula. It's kind of the Caribbean side of Mexico. And one of the little
jungle translations.
Oh, it's a jungle.
Isn't it in the jungle?
And one of the literal translations of Campeche is logwood, because the area has been just extensively logged. And, you know, when I think of jungle, I think of a tropical Hawaii-type jungle. You know, that's what I think of jungle. Well, Campeche is not that kind of jungle. It's a dog hair thick hardwood thicket of a jungle. It's thick and it's hot, but it's a little dry, like you expect Mexico to be. And as a forester and naturalist, you know, I was just amazed, for example, almost distracted by the fact that, you know, here we are, you walked out in the woods this morning turkey hunting, and the red maples are blooming or have bloomed, starting to lose their bloom with this rain we're getting. You've got the elms coming on strong. There's pollen everywhere. The pines are just about to explode in the pollen galore. You know, everything, or the trees are budding out. You know, I've been noticing a lot of them. Maples and hickories and oaks, just their buds are just about boom to explode into foliage. Well, down there in Campeche, it's all the seasons going on at one time. You've got trees that are fruiting, you got trees that are senescing their leaves, fixing to go dormant. You've got trees that are fixing to bud out. You've got trees that are flowering. It's pretty amazing. It's such a species diversity in that jungle. I just thought it was real amazing to see that dynamic going on. But it was just an incredible experience. And I've been down there a couple of times, and I've loved it both times. And I'll tell you, there's both times we've hunted, we've been within 20 or 30 miles of some prominent Mayan ruins called Edna Ruins, which was a temple of sorts, pretty big compound. I've actually walked through it now. And so you're just in this land of Mayan Indians, and it's like a lot of the woods have been cut at some point in time. And but like I remember, I don't exactly remember the name of that tree. I want to say it was Ombui tree, but it was the name of the tree. But like there was always this one tree. Every now and again, you see this one tree that just grew head and shoulders above the forest. And one of my hosts explained to me one time that, you know, do you remember that show, that Hollywood blockbuster movie with the big blue Martians, you know, and they're all attached to this tree, and the tree was life and all this good stuff. Well, the Mexican kind of explained to me that a lot of the loggers and natives wouldn't cut that species of tree because it just had some kind of cultural value to them. And so they just left them. And you'd see them every now and again just out there on the landscape, these great big giant trees, and just growing head towering above the rest of the forest. And I'll tell you the story. We went to this little town called, first time called Tikmakui, and it's just a sleepy little Mexican village. A lot of the houses don't have windows and bars. It's hot as blue blazes. I noticed just from being in a few of them homes that the locals sleep in hammocks. I mean, they just hang a hammock up because it's so hot, you know. And they had us in this little villa, had air conditioning, little grass roof apartment or hotel like place that had air conditioning. But let me tell you what, when they crank that generator on at night, we turned the air conditioning on, we slept really good. I don't think I'd have slept very well in a hammock. And, you know, it's just, but Tikmakui was just an extremely, you know, they're just workers and laborers and simple people. And there was just this old man in town, and his sons were our guides, and they were the best woodsmen I've ever met in my life. I never forget one time we were walking down. It was hot, and we were walking across this pasture, apparently down to some water, and the guide kept pointing at the cattle trail we were walking down and saying, "Pablo, Pablo." I kind of got what he was saying. Yeah, turkeys use this trail. We're going to go down here to sit out in this hot sun and wait on a turkey. And he said, "No, no, senor, Pablo, Pablo, Pablo." And he crouched down and was pointing. And, yeah, yeah. And I could see this hard-baked trail cutting out through there. And he kind of put his hand on my head and pushed it toward the ground. And as he got the sun just right, I could see there was a turkey track. So, yeah, turkeys are walking down this trail to the water. I got it. Yeah, I get it. I didn't have to crouch all the way down here to see that. I get what you're saying. And we got down there about 100 more yards. About that time, this turkey exploded from cover. About 20, 30 yards, this oscillated turkey jumped up. And that, it looked like a police siren. There was so much, just the way that sun hit that blue and that gold on that bird, it was spellbinding. I mean, if had it been a duck or a goose, anybody could have shot it, just boom, snapshot it. That's what he'd expect me to do. Well, I didn't know what, it was so spellbinding to see that turkey in the sun flying like that I couldn't move. I just watched him fly off thinking, that's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. So what he'd been telling me was, there's a turkey ahead of us, get ready to shoot him when he flies. But I just missed the translation on that. I saw the turkey tracks he showed me. But long story short, we went back, the next morning, and got on that turkey. But there was another morning, he and I, we all kind of gathered on this road, woods on either side, and the operator turned on real loud speaker that was playing the cantor, is what they call the male oscillated. It was playing the cantor's call, It's a real strange call. I used to, back when I had a phone, I remember having a phone that I actually had that as a ringtone. It was an oscillated call. It wasn't no doubt whose phone was ringing when that thing went off. So, such a strange song. And the reason they did that is because those oscillated turkeys are not turkeys in a conventional sense that ours are. You know, like right now, a lot of these gobblers may still be running around in bachelor groups. Certainly times of year they do. And then they break off, you know, and start running around chasing hens, you know, competing and for hens. Well, down there, the best I can understand, those oscillated turkeys are to me a lot more like a game chicken. I mean, they're a fighting cock. They just got long spurs and never really get together. They're off on their own, solitary, chasing hens during the breeding season and doing their own thing when it's not that time of season. And by playing that call, it'll initiate another cantor to sing. And so we had walked way down this through this thicket, and we'd gone along this concrete flume that it was kind of like a three-sided ditch. It appeared to have concrete slabs on the side and concrete slab on the bottom, and it just wound through these woods, and we had stuck to that trail right along this dried-up concrete flume and had sat for a while, and finally could hear the call back on the road going. Finally, we heard that turkey off in the woods singing, and my guide he pursed his lips, and I could see that he was whistling. Embera, embera, he kept saying, female. It was such a high-pitched whistle, I couldn't hear it. And that turkey started getting closer. So, you know, see the game's going on back over here on the road. You got this cantor singing, this electronic cantor singing, and over here you got this real cantor, and in the middle you've got a hen singing. Well, here comes the real oscillated turkey to intercept the hen. And so we kind of started proceeding towards him singing. And about that time, he let off his song. And, I mean, he was pretty close. So we just, boom, sat down. And just when I sat down and got ready to pull my knees up and got my gun up, Rocky, I was just in this thicket. I couldn't see nothing. I couldn't see maybe 5 feet, 6 feet, 7, 8 feet in front of me. I couldn't see nothing. I was just, what am I going to do? Because I'm just right here looking at this little grass thicket, and I can't see a dang thing. Well, the guide had laid down on his belly behind me and, like, pulled his shirt up over his head and was just looking through the hole, the neck of it, and was laid on the ground. And that turkey got so close, it's like my inner ear was rattling when he would sing. It's like it was tickling the inside of my head when he would sing. And he was right there. And about the time that guy started pushing me in my lower back, started putting his hand and kind of like pushing me a little bit, I'm wondering, you know, what's he saying? He's saying, shoot. You know, I can't see anything. I mean, it's a turkey right there. I'm supposed to be shooting him. This bird was right sitting in my lap. I just couldn't see him. And there directly we hear this, roar throughout the woods and the jungle. Just all the birds quit singing. That turkey shut up. You could hear him just step walking away. Everything got quiet. That was a jaguar roaring. Everything got quiet when the king spoke. So we stood up and walked back to the truck. And I asked the translator, I said, ask him why he's pressing me in the back. Was I supposed to just pull the trigger blindly? Or he goes, no. When he was laying down, he could see up under that grass. And he could see the turkey's feet and spurs. It says he was about 8 meters away. He was just trying to tell you to get ready, because if he kept coming, he's going to be right at the end of your gun barrel.
He's going to bite your gun barrel. Good grief.
Oh, yeah, I could have hit him with it if he'd come on in. And that was pretty thrilling. I'm not going to lie to you. That was exciting. And I'm in this jungle and all this stuff. And, you know, I even found out later, I asked about, you know, cause I got to wondering, why would somebody spend all that time and money building a concrete ditch that ran for miles through the jungle? And my host looked at me like I was silly. He said, well, this used to be agriculture. I said, oh. He said, and that's not concrete. It's limestone. That the Mayans built it. See, Rocky, and that part of, you know, that Caribbean part of Mexico, that's where that great big meteor hit Earth that put all the particulate up in the atmosphere to kill the dinosaurs. And part of it did that, it created these real deep water, freshwater bodies they call cenotes. And the Mayans, besides inventing the number zero, which that's pretty dang smart if you think about it. You know, they actually came up with, they actually figured out a way, these primitive people figured out a way to get that water to the surface, which in Mexico, even tropical Mexico like Caribbean, or jungle Mexico, that's a pretty good way to be because Mexico's dry. And they figured out how to get all this fresh water out and irrigate crops and build a whole flourishing Mayan civilization around all this water. And so that was just kind of interesting that you know, thousands of years, I guess, later, you know, here we are prowling around, you know, turkey hunting, and we're all at their old remnants were laying out. That's just kind of cool. And, you know, sometimes you'd be walking through that jungle and just he would stop and point, and you see these stones and these old slabs and little short walls, and he just, and it wasn't any bigger than your kitchen. He'd just say, Maya, Maya. You know, 'cause it was an old house or building or something out from that ruins that where the Mayans had been. That to me is just kind of interesting. You know, I like that kind of stuff. And so we went back. That turkey we had jumped out in that pasture that day, we went back that next morning and sat, just waited and waited for it to get daylight. Finally got daylight. Just as it was starting to get daylight, we heard him sing. And, you know, too many years of unprotected shooting. Go ahead.
You were describing these turkeys just a minute ago. Would you say they're more kin to a peacock than a turkey?
Yeah, I would say I would I don't know about a peacock, but I would think they're more kin to a fighting rooster than a conventional turkey. You know, they're a turkey. They taste like a turkey. You know, they don't have beards. They got big, long, sharp fighting spurs like one of them fighting roosters. You know, and but we got there that morning when we heard that turkey singing, and it's certainly the one I'd jumped in the pasture right there walking down that cow trail, and it was pretty dang easy. Now, and I get from hearing stories of guys that hunt eastern turkeys about, you know, not, you know, walking up to one and shooting him out of a tree. I get that, but let me tell you, an isolated turkey is not like shooting an eastern, and sneaking up on them. Mexico is not like walking through a pine thicket after a rain and silent as a ghost and shooting old roosted turkey. It ain't like that at all. You know, you shoot an isolated turkey whenever you can get him in sights. Because you're not necessarily going to call him in like you do our turkeys. It's a different game. And so we found that turkey. We kept going to the sound, and there was about a about a belt high, 3 foot tall termite mound, something out there, and ant bed, and you know, my guy crawled up, peeked up over it, and got back down and crawled back the way he'd come and sent me, and I crawled up and peeked up over it, and there he was about 8 foot off the ground singing, and I leveled up on him but just sat there and watched him for a minute singing, 'cause I thought, you know, he's a beautiful bird. That was my first isolated turkey, and the next one we went for. That was a memorable story because, you know, we were walking one evening. I guess it was the last evening or next to last evening we were down there. We were walking down this long gravel road through the woods. As far as I know, that road went forever. And we were just walking. And there directly I looked up, and way off in the distance coming our way, somebody else walking our way. And as we got closer, my guide, you know, knew me, old gringo, not much of a turkey hunter, and he kind of turned around. We got near that guy, and he turned around and, you know, put his finger to his lip like, be quiet. And I did recognize him as this guy's brother, one of the old man's other sons, who was the scout. And we just continued on walking. You know, our path crossed, and he went the way we'd come, and we just kept walking the way he came. And there directly, my guide stopped, so I stopped, and he whispered. I said, honey, he said, shh, shh, shh. He was whispering. I mean, over the distance of 100-some-odd yards, this Mexican was whispering. And I looked behind me, he was whispering to his brother. They were having a conversation at whisper level. Rocky, I've shot, been around, too many rock concerts and shot so many years with unprotected, without any hearing protection, and I'm lucky to hear it thunder, and let alone hear a man whisper from 100 yards away, even in a quiet jungle. And they had this conversation, so my guide indicated for us to sit. And so I just sat in the road, and then we sat there long enough. I kind of laid down and got comfortable, and he did too. And as it started getting darker, got up and went back the way we'd come, and we went and sat again right where his brother had stopped and pointed to the road, pointed on the road, and left a little stone right in the middle of the road. And we went and sat right by that little stone and just sat there, and it kept getting darker and darker, and I'd close my eyes and pull my hat down and was just about dozing when we heard a turkey singing. He started singing and getting closer and closer, and then we heard, flew up, got in a tree about 100, 150 yards away, I would say. And that's the game. And, if you ain't ever done it, don't judge it. I'm going to tell you what. Like I say, walking through those woods, they're dry. It's hard woods. You know how hard it is to walk in the fall, through a hardwood bottom in the south. How noisy it is. Well, that's kind of like this, only it's a lot thicker. And, stem density is just unbelievable. A guy, like an Indian, he was a masterful woodsman. He could move through the woods like smoke. I moved through the woods like a Kid Rock concert, trying to be quiet, but I'm just making all kinds of noise. He scolded me the whole way in. And it had gotten pretty dark. And finally he stopped and faced me and was through hand motion, he kept kind of swatting at his wrist, and I'm thinking, what's he trying to say? Well, what he was saying was he wanted me to pull my shirt sleeve down and cover the face of my watch in the dark. Just, okay, I did. And he kind of indicated for me to sit still and not move and not talk. And then, mid-conversation or so, he just vanished. And I mean, I didn't hear nothing. I didn't, it was like 1 minute he's right here. I can kind of make out his facial features and his hand movements right there in the dark in front of me. And the next second, he's gone. And I'm like, got my arm stretched out in front of me, reaching around, trying to say, where is this guy? He was gone. I don't know if he was gone for 20 minutes or 40 minutes. He was gone a while, though. And Rocky was so quiet in those woods that I'd feel a bead of sweat come down my nose and hang right there on the edge and drop. And I'd hear it hit the leaves, drop. It was so silent. I could hear my sweat hitting the leaves. But I could not hear this man when he walked off. And when he appeared back in front of me, it's a wonder I didn't holler. I know I ran in place momentarily because it scared me. I mean, just here I am minding my own business in the pitch black dark, wondering where this guy went. And it's, he all of a sudden, he's right in front of me. And he motioned for me to come with him, and I followed him. And, we were walking. I was a little quieter than I'd ever been because I wasn't stepping on any sticks, and I wasn't catching any branches that I couldn't see in the dark. Because 20, 30, 40 minutes, whenever he'd been gone, he had created a trail between where I was standing and where that turkey, and that was it. The reason we stopped walking in is because I'd woke that turkey up. That turkey started click, 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 getting all nervous up on the limb. He'd gone to sleep, and Mr. Kid Rock concert walking through the woods woke that oscillated turkey up. So this man had disappeared, my guide had disappeared, and what he'd done is he'd gone ahead of me. He'd very likely gotten all them little switches on them trees out of the way, and any little sticks and debris that had been laying out, he got it out of the way. We walked, 30, 40 yards more, 50 yards more.
Hold on. Let me make sure I heard this right. So he walked ahead and cleared a trail for you?
Yeah.
To get to this bird?
He, in the pitch black dark. And I couldn't hear a sound. I couldn't hear him when he walked. I could hear sweat coming off my body and hitting the leaves, but I couldn't hear this man doing all this. And it wasn't until I realized as I was following him in round two, proceeding on to this bird that had gone back to sleep, that I realized what he had done. He got all the little twig, all the little everything out of the way, so old Loud Ramsey Gringo doesn't step on it and wake this bird up again. He wanted me to get this bird. You know, isn't that crazy? And
wow, the
guy was the best woodsman I'd ever seen, Rocky. It was unbelievable. And we had hunted in between the first turkey and this last turkey. We had hunted very, very hard. Spent a lot of time out in the woods trying to get a deer, and I didn't even see one. And that deer hunt was a lot different because they carry these little book bags, these little school bags or little knapsacks or something behind them, and man, they got all kinds of stuff inside that bag. You know, they'll have a ball of twine, like plastic twine, you know, like a bell hay with. They'll have a knife or two, might have a little cloth, little something. And they always got these balled up little hammocks, one for me, one for him. And about the size of a softball, when you unfurl it, it's not like a great big hammock, like what they would sleep in. It was a short hammock. And it's really a wonder. Hey, you want to make $1 million in deer hunt? This is a great idea because this is how they hunted. It is out of these little short hammocks that you could tie between two trees about 4 or 5 foot apart, 6 foot apart. And sometimes near to the ground. And sometimes Rocky, he would break out his machete and pop, 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 cut a dozen saplings and right there in front of you just lash them together and make a ladder, climb up, 8 foot, 9 foot off the ground and hang that hammock, lay another cross piece for himself to another tree, and he'd hang his hammock, and we'd sit up there just in that tree. And you want to talk about comfortable. I've never been in a deer stand, nobody's deer stand in terms of a climbing type stand or ladder stand, never been in a deer stand off the ground other than a big, comfortable, manufactured house with an office chair in it that I've been that comfortable. Because you can put your feet in that thing and fall asleep. You can sit up. You can lean down. You're comfortable. Your butt doesn't fall asleep. You're steady. You're not going to fall out the way that thing wraps up on you. You can sit there all day. I have. It's like sitting in your mama's arms. You're just sitting right there as comfortable as you've ever been sitting in a tree. And that's how we hunted. We just didn't, hunting around food sources and water sources, and we just, for whatever luck, didn't see a bracket there that trip. And do you know, at the end of the trip, we'd gone over to the old man's house, and I know I'm going to get back to shooting this turkey. We'd gone to the old man's house to get our permits and get our paperwork, and they very, gosh, such poor people. His little home was maybe twice the size of my bedroom, barren, and out in the backyard. It was just beat down dirt under some shade trees. And that family, just those boys and his wife and he, the women worked. The men would sit outside. And as the sun moved, the shadows would move, and they'd move their chairs and stay in the shadows. And there was chickens and turkeys in the backyard. And it was just beat down to hard clay dirt. And out back, he had a stove made out of cinder blocks, a little wooden stove, and they could cook on it and everything else. And that was a luxury. He was one of the big shots in town that had all this good stuff, And they had us come over, and back was this old wooden table with hatchet marks from where he had, taken his machete and chopped the heads off a million chickens over the years and oscillated turkeys over the years and turkeys and whatever else, had cleaned them. His wife had taken that second oscillated turkey and made a turkey mole sauce. And, mole is that dark Spanish sauce. And every little family and everybody's got to make a different mole based on their family tradition. And it was the best mole sauce I've ever, some of those mole sauce, they have a little bitter chocolate in it or something like that. And it was just this wonderful, savory turkey mole that she cooked on that outside stove. And, we were the honored guest, so just a couple of us. So, you know, they went inside and got a clean cloth and covered up that table that, you know, that they otherwise used as a work table out in the backyard, chopping heads off of chickens. And we sat and ate that turkey mole sauce on a clean surface. And it just wonderful, wonderful people. Could tell stories and tell you about the history. And, you know, just like we said in other podcasts, people love when you're in their country and you're into that kind of stuff, they love to tell about their country and their culture and things of that nature. And that was during that visit, because we were fixing to leave, my guide had gone into, had disappeared for a minute. When he came back, he had two sets of brocket deer antlers. And, you know, look, I'm holding up my index finger and my ring finger, you know, just kind of holding them up. And that's how wide and about how long that little skull plate with them antlers are on there. And he gave me a set, and he gave the other guy a pair. And, you know, nothing special, just a little set of spiked antlers. And as he, and I thanked him profusely. And when he left, the host said, you know, you should have that scored when you get home. I go, huh? This little thing goes, yeah. He ran, but you got to remember, these guys don't hunt for sport. They go deer hunting. They're feeding their family. And the fact that he kept those antlers ought to tell you how big it is. That's a really big brocket deer. And so, you know, but we had hunted hard and connected, and he just wanted me to have a set, you know, just went to his pile and pulled out a big set of them and gave them to me. And I keep them, you know, not because I killed it or, you know, nothing like that, but I kept them and I keep them in a place, you know, right near where I got this oscillated turkey mounted, because it's, you know, I thought just such a great thing the week I spent with him in that jungle. He knew the trees, and he would try to explain to me in Spanish about, you know, what's fruiting and the rain and the bird habits and the jaguars, and just, you know, I just really, really enjoyed hunting with this guy. And that evening, back to the jungle, you know, he had gone ahead and cleared this trail as best he could, and I was fairly silent.
You got to put this in here.
The rest of the story. And so now we're back in the jungle, and we're, you know, and we stop, and he turns around and he taps my chest and asks for my Stingray light. He had a light in his backpack, but it was just a little old battery operated light. It wasn't a Stingray. You don't want him ultra bright lights. And I handed it to him, and he indicated to get ready. So, you know, I kind of raised my gun up, kind of, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, you know, it's pitch black dark. The turkey's somewhere around here, so he's going to turn the light on and sweep through the woods like he's shining a field or shining a ditch bank looking for a frog you hear croaking. No, he want to know, get ready. And when he turned that light on, put it right on that turkey. He could see that turkey in pitch black dark. He knew exactly where that turkey was. I couldn't see nothing but just shadows, and, you know, I was in a dark jungle. And when he turned it on, he put it right on that turkey. And, of course, the rest of his, you just pull the trigger, they fall. But, you know, it was a that hunt, you know, yeah, shooting a couple of isolated turkeys, and to me, it's still one of the most beautiful game birds. An isolated turkey is one of the most beautiful game birds in the world. And even down in Campeche, the town of Campeche, it's an amazing town. It's part of the Caribbean, Mexico, okay? It's like the old downtown. It's got this Spanish fort walled around it, old cannons, you know, because that's where Mad Jack and all them pirates would come in and raid and all that good stuff. You know, it was real pirate town. And you know Rocky, the oldest church in North America is right there in a little town of Merida out in Campeche. It's an old Spanish church in the town of Merida, the White City. And it's got little slots, little skinny slots for sticking them blunderbuss out and shooting the fighting Indians if they had to. And it's built right in the town square, which is the old fort of the town of Merida. and built under colonial rule, but it's the oldest church in North America still standing. And my host preceding this trip, we'd been talking, and we walked across the square, and there was this old facade, this old it would have been an old bank. Remember, we're inside the square, so we'd have been inside the fort walls. And he was telling me, he said, you know, if you can see the relief, you can see the carvings and understand what is carved into these columns, you know, decoratively carved into this old bank, then you'll understand the history of Mexico. I mean, it was kind of dark outside, you know, squinting, looking, you know, and man, we're pulling out our cell phones to kind of shine them up there, you know, and he said, look. And what it was these Spanish conquistadors, you know, with their armor on and holding a double bit axe, and each conquistador soldier is standing on these little round things. Each foot is planted on these little round things. And I said, oh, it's conquistadors. He said, no, look at what he's standing on. That's the history of Mexico. That's all you need to know about the history of Mexico. And we got a light going. I finally realized what it was, is they were standing on human heads. And because conquistadors, the Spanish conquistadors came into Mexico, and they didn't negotiate, they didn't make treaties, they conquered. They were standing on those Mayan heads. And that was the history of Mexico, he was telling me. The conquistadors landed, and they killed, and they took. And that was the history of his country. And, you know, and that was down in Merida. But if you get into to Campeche, closer to the action, the town of Campeche, you know, you got to remember now that you don't think, yeah, you got tacos and you got mole sauce, but no, you're right there on the Caribbean Sea and, you know, the Gulf. You got a whole lot of seafood culture going on too. Like one of my favorite restaurants down by the Holiday Inn, you cross the highway, you're sitting there drinking. They got margaritas. They got all kinds of margaritas. And you know, you'll sit there drinking sapote margarita or whatever like that. You see these two little boys out there swimming in the surf, and they keep diving under and popping up. You know, probably 10 foot of water. They'll dive under, be gone for a minute, come up and drop something in this inner tube that's got a little net in between the hole in the middle, and then shortly, when you don't see them out there swimming no more, the maitre d' comes in with a platter full of lobsters and conch or whatever else. And, you know, this is the fresh dinner selection for tonight. And you know, like I was in this old, beautiful restaurant in downtown Campeche one time, and it was just old and beautiful. And, like, the glass work was, you know, it's like, you know, the doors were, like, rounded at the top, you know, like arcs, like rounded, and had these lights, these beautiful glass, pane glass above them. And as I was sitting there eating dinner, I kept to look, it was this blue with gold tip glass, and I realized that's an oscillated turkey. That's the fan, the pane glass throughout the restaurant. This restaurant was old. I mean, it had to be 100 years old. It was an old restaurant, just an old building. They come in and you know, but it was an oscillated turkey fan. You know, it is what it was. So it's real, you know, the whole culture seeped around this. And to me, when I sit there in my game room and I look at that oscillated turkey, I see this blue, this bright, sparkling blue that when this light hits it right, it just, boom, it parts like a police siren, and it's all edged in gold. And that when the sun hits it right, all you see is all this little gold, 24 karat gold outline, and it's an ugly old head, you know, that only mama would love. It's light blue head, and each eye is ringed with just big puffy red eyelids, and then on top of his head he's got this corona, this crown of gold, and it looks Mayan to me. It looks like a Mayan chief, like a Mayan. It's just painted his face blue and outlined his eyes in red, and he's got this gold crown on. And that's just kind of you see where I'm getting with this, Rocky. Shot a couple of turkeys, but it was just that whole jungle experience that was so profound. You know, the second time I went to that area to shoot oscillated turkeys, I think there were six of us, and in 3 days, we shot a curacao, two or three brocket deer. I didn't get a brocket deer. A javelina, and 11 oscillated turkeys. I didn't shoot an oscillated. Could have shot three of them very easily from a blind, one of them hammocks. I could have killed two of them. We were hunting a fruit tree called sapote, and it's just like eating these little brown sugar cubes. And dope boy, believe you me, those Indian guys know exactly where those trees are because everything in the jungle comes to eat that sapote fruit. And we were, and the last thing my guide told me, my outfit told me before I left was, hey, if you see a javelina, shoot it. I said, uh-uh. He said, no, Ramby, it's the best thing in the jungle you've ever eaten. I said, I don't believe you. You ever smelt a javelina, Rocky, collared peccary? They smell like a polecat. They got a big old gland on their back. It's like a boob. It stinks. I'm like, he said, if you see a javelina, please shoot it. If you like that deer we roasted last night, you'll love this javelina. And so... we were sitting in there hunting, and you could hear that oscillated cantor out there. He knew where that fruit tree was too, and he was making rounds. And he didn't come into that tree, but he got right around the periphery and was singing in case there was a hen up under there feeding. And he was 40 yards. I at one time walking through a little gap in the thicket, I could have got a good clear shot at him. Couldn't get a good picture. But I could have killed him with a shotgun easy, and I did. And we were waiting on a deer. I did get some pictures, not great pictures, but pictures, and did shoot a javelina, and it was good. You know, they dug that particular camp. We were camped in the jungle in tents, like screen netted tents with a bed, and you know, as warm as it was during the day, at night, you'd wake up under all the covers because you're out in that jungle area, you know, and the humidity and it cool off at night. And they made a big pit. The cook made a big, like dug a pit, put, you know, hot coal down there and layered it with wet vegetation. And then it kind of covered it with dirt on top and let it roast all day, like a big old crock pot roast. He'd pull that meat out, and he just pulled it off the bone and shredded it like pulled pork. Put lime, lemons, and onions, and just a little vinegar, and made this homemade tortillas, and we ate these little homemade taquerias, and it was fabulous. I couldn't believe it. I mean, the one thing I noticed on that javelina I shot, they put him in the back of the truck, like a Suburban, on the drive back. I couldn't smell him. You know, I mean, for some reason, he didn't have that odor. And I'm sure the guy was very careful the way he dressed that animal when he pulled it out, because it really was very, very, it was good as pork. You know, that was a, you know, it's kind of to me, it was interesting being immersed in the jungle. You know, I never forget every afternoon if you were around camp before it got dark enough to go out and hunt, if you were going to chase them at night, you know, or after, you know, chase a roosted bird like we described, all these monkeys would come over camp swinging through. And one time there was a toucan in camp just kind of hanging around. That's kind of cool to see that stuff. But that you know, I'm still not a turkey hunter, Rocky, but I liked that oscillated turkey experience.
You were almost Paul Harvey-esque today in telling that story. Came real close.
Good.
Man, I know you got to get to a meeting this afternoon, but never.
No. It's going to be a meeting, all right. Me and my buddy Rance Gamlin are fixing to go eat some crawfish. I've been gone 2-3 weeks, and I've eaten my homemade hamburger. You know, the one food I crave when I've been on the road traveling to a foreign country, and the food in Azerbaijan is very, very good. I got to have my homemade hamburger when I get home. And now it's crawfish season, and I'm fixing to go eat crawfish. My buddy Rance and our wives, and I'm sure Forrest will come along because he's not one to pass up on a free crawfish dinner. So we're just going to drink a couple of cold beers and eat crawfish. Sorry it took so long to get together, Rocky.
Oh, man. We both been busy. I have enjoyed it. Ramsey, thank you for coming in. And like I said, never imagined we were going to talk turkey, but great, great stories. Thank you again. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.